From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The midterm elections this past November were a strong rebuke to the Trump presidency. The wave of young, first-time progressives winning office was part of a strategy of resistance 2 years in the making. There have been more mass protests in the U.S. in the years since Trump became president than at any other time in the nation's history. Now a new book put this new wave of resistance and organizing into historical context and attempts to understand how protest works and how it can be maximized as a tool for change rather than just an outlet for collective frustration. The author of that book is L.A. Kaufman, who has spent more than 35 years immersed in grassroots movements as a journalist, historian, organizer, and strategist. Her writings on organizing and social movement history have been published in The Guardian, The Nation, The Progressive, Mother Jones, The Village Voice, and more. Her earlier book was called Direct Action, Protest and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. She now joins me to discuss her newest book, How to Read a Protest, The Art of Organizing and Resistance. Welcome to the program, LA.
Thanks so much for having me, Sonali.
So we live at this very interesting time where there's a huge disconnect between popular sentiment and people in government, which of course is the perfect recipe for grassroots activism and a pushback from below. How historic have these protests that started since Trump's election, you know, really even at the day after the election, there were mass protests, and then the day before his inauguration, how significant have these been when we put into context or for comparison purposes the 2016, 2017, and 2018 protests in the long arc of the history of American protest?
Well, it's really quite striking how much more protest there is now than has ever been documented in the past. It's very difficult to get numbers on protests. It can be difficult to estimate how many people are at any given event because people come and go. The borders of who's a participant and who's a sympathetic observer can be very fluid. And the data's complicated over time. But when I've looked closely at the numbers, I'm struck by how many more individual protests have taken place since Trump took office. There's been at least 20,000. And how many more people have taken part? Going up through this past fall, the numbers are somewhere between 14 and 21 million people participating in protests. And that dwarfs even the numbers that we saw adjusted for population growth in what we think of as the high point of protest in American history, the late 60s and early 70s. Many more people are active and engaged and speaking out now.
So I'm assuming that the way in which these protests have been organized, and as you write about in your book, is also quite different from protests in the past. So, for example, the Women's March in 2017 was this incredibly women-centered march, obviously, by definition, but also very much organized by women. In contrast, the protests of the 1960s and 70s were not as women-led, were they?
Well, that's kind of a great understatement. In this new book, I look very closely at the organizing of what we think of as kind of the emblematic protest in American history, the 63 March on Washington, where Dr. King delivered his I Have a Dream speech. And among the themes that I explore, the aspects of that march that aren't usually discussed or well understood, is the extent to which women simultaneously did much of the work of actually mobilizing people to get there, doing the nuts and bolts work that brought what was at that point an unprecedented crowd to Washington. There had never before been 250,000 people marching in Washington, D.C. So women really anchored that mobilizing work, but were completely sidelined from any involvement in the decision making and even any public role. There were 10 speakers that day. Dr. King was the last of a group of 10, and every effort to have a woman be among the speakers that day was rebuffed. Obviously, things have changed a lot in the interim, not just in that, the composition, the demographics of who's involved, but how the organizing happens.
So what have we, I mean, there have been books, many, many books written about how protest translated into actual change. And the civil rights movement offers a great history lesson. The protests against the Vietnam War also offer a great history lesson. One of the things that we forget is how critical those protests in the 70s were to ending the Vietnam War. And you have a section in your book about the 1971 May Day March, which offers us really a really good lesson for today. Tell us about that march and how it translated into actual change.
Well, the May Day 71 was very, very striking because it actually wasn't a march. It was a massive direct action with the slogan, "If the government won't stop the war, the people will stop the government." And it was a massive, decentralized day of direct action that was that intended to paralyze the government in Washington, D.C. by shutting down streets and bridges and subways and everything you can think of, blockading buildings. And it did, you know, it did paralyze the city briefly. The Nixon administration responded with what are the largest number of arrests ever in U.S. history. Over 10,000 people were arrested that day and rounded up and herded into a stadium, into RFK Stadium. The numbers were so large. And it was one of quite a few things that led Nixon to feel that he couldn't continue with the war the way that he had. He needed to begin exploring options for some kind of U.S. withdrawal. You know, generally the way protests work, what happens oftentimes is there'll be a big day of protest and there's an eagerness to, you know, to weigh in on it immediately and say what it did or did accomplish. And it's very hard to see right away. It's rare. I mean, there are occasions when you have a protest and you know, your target gives into your demand immediately. But so many times, particularly when the objectives are something as big as stopping a war or trying to dislodge an authoritarian presidency, the effects of any single protest can't be seen immediately. You have to see where they fit into a larger picture of a movement and a campaign of pressure, and how those effects unfold over time. Mm-hmm.
You raised an important distinction just now in your clarification of my question, which is there's a difference between a march and direct action. They're both forms of protest, but they are very, very different forms of protest. How do we measure these differences? I imagine that a direct action is something that, because the risks involved are so much higher, are necessarily smaller actions, are necessarily taken by those people who understand that they are putting their bodies at risk, whereas a big march is something that offers a way for a much broader cross-section of society to participate. But do they have different outcomes as well?
Absolutely. You know, it's really important when looking at protests not to conflate their size with their power or their impact, because sometimes the very largest protests can have a very diffuse impact that's hard to see, whereas a very small targeted direct action that involves a tiny number of people can have a very clear short-term effect as a pressure tactic. Large mobilizations, the big marches, starting with the 63 March on Washington and continuing through the women's marches that have happened, you know, that happened the day after Trump's inauguration and again on the anniversary of that, it will happen again in January. Those function differently, and people often look at them and want them to work like a pressure tactic, but they really don't. It's very hard to come up with an example with a big mass march that worked in the short term to change policy or pass legislation. What they do is something that's crucial, but that's often not recognized, which is that they play a really crucial role in building and sustaining movements. In ways that some of which are very immediate and bodily for people who participate in those events. There's a power in being in a big crowd of people who share your views and your desire for change, that there's that way in which having that very direct lived sense of being part of something larger than yourself can really inspire people and lead them to do all kinds of ongoing action, the kind of other kinds of action that are required to make change. The big marches, people will often feel a little frustrated afterwards because it's sort of like all these people come together and what did it produce? And part of what it produces when it works well is that sense of motion, that sense of belonging, that sense of there being a real movement.
And one also, I mean, for me, I also wonder, we have the sense of if a tree falls in a forest and nobody heard it, did it really fall? If a protest happens, but the media didn't cover it, did it really happen? Do you think that that's a too limiting a way to look at it?
I think it is. I mean, I think, you know, for instance, the first round of women's marches had an extraordinary media impact. The second round, not so much. There was very little coverage, even though the numbers were almost as large as they were the first time around. And once again, part of what's so striking about the women's marches, to my mind as a historian, is not just the total number of people who have marched to these events, but the number of places where they've occurred, which is really record-breaking. The first round of women's marches happened in some 650 communities around the U.S., and it's very difficult to come up with previous days of coordinated action. You know, that's a thing that people do. They hold protests in multiple cities on the same day, but it rarely had happened in more than 200 cities on a single day. So when I look at the impact of, say, that second round of women's marches, I look over the long run at how having that sense of community, of a community of opposition in all these hundreds of places, there were 400 some the second round, helped fuel, for instance, what we saw happen in the midterms, where we saw remarkable levels of volunteer engagement in get out the vote efforts all around the country in all kinds of places that we don't think of as being hotbeds of activism.
And those aren't as visible in the media, but they're happening.
That's right. That's right. And I think the marches, you know, the marches that happened on the year anniversary of the first set of women's marches, those weren't so visible, but they mattered to the people who went to them. And those who are often the same people who then would set up pop-up canvassing sites or coordinate, you know, phone banking, or, you know, did all of that, that crucial work that's often, you know, below the radar, but, you know, leads to real change, as we saw with the very striking cumulative set of results from the midterms.
We brought up a comparison of the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War protests, but what about the 2003 marches against the war in Iraq? Those were similar to the Women's March in that there were coordinated protests happening in many communities, not just in the U.S., but around the world. I know that you were very much an organizer in those marches. How did those differ from what's happening today and what's happened just in the last few years?
Well, I'm glad you asked about that, because it was my experience working on those marches haunted me for years afterwards, and is part of what motivated the writing of this book. I was the mobilizing coordinator for United for Peace and Justice, which organized the biggest of those. They organized the big marches in New York and later D.C. against the Iraq War, and served as a hub for all the actions that were happening around the country and the world. And the contrast between what felt like some of the most powerful organizing hustle I've ever experienced, people felt so impassioned to try to stop that war from happening and put really the best of their efforts into the work to stop it. We had, you know, we had a volunteer operation in New York that I still look back on and my jaw drops. We had thousands of volunteers who handed out more than 2 million pieces of literature around the city at Wow. every single subway stop in the city. I mean, we had just an incredible, you know, people were just really rose to the occasion. And yet, you know, you can look at the numbers worldwide, which are still are record breaking for a global day of protest, of the February 15th, 2003 anti-war protest. And it did not do what it was intended to do, which was stop the war. Now, it's not clear to me that anything could have stopped that war, and I certainly think it was worth it to have tried. I never regretted the work that we did to try to do it. But that was an example where, you know, in many cases, a big mobilization like this can help really build and sustain a movement. And you know, there was an ongoing anti-war movement, but it was a very different dynamic where we kind of started with our biggest, best effort. And there was a slow decline from that point onward. It was never possible to get quite the same numbers again out in the streets. People felt very dispirited and discouraged, and in a way that allowed me to see over time how important morale is in movements, and how the contrasting example with the women's marches, that those have been really important sources of a morale boost for our movements in what, particularly the first set, which really broke an incredible spell of kind of paralysis and fear that a lot of people had after Trump was elected. The bottom line is that we can't always win. There are times when we simply, even if we march in massive numbers, we do not have the power to go up against, a global empire. And maybe there was nothing that could have stopped that war. But there are moments when the response to a protest, forces us to take a cold, hard look at the balance of power and say that even though we may have the numbers, we don't have the power.
Well, I'm wondering if some of what took place with the Iraq protests were lessons that were learned and implemented with the Women's March, or is it just that fighting a foreign policy issue like war, especially one that's, essentially bipartisan, is so much harder than doing creating change domestically, or both? It was both, that people learned the lessons from the Iraq War protests and that domestic change is easier to rally people around.
I think there's some of that. I mean, the first set of women's marches emerged so organically that it's a little hard to say that people were, building on lessons from the past. I mean, because it was so much of a groundswell all around the country.
Right, a lot of first-time activists, right? Which was also the case around the Iraq War. A lot of people protested the Bush administration, who had never ever participated in protests before.
Absolutely, but the organizing was mostly done by seasoned activists. What happened with the women's marches were a lot of the people who stepped up to lead the local marches and take on the organizing roles were people who, had maybe organized some non-political something activity in their lives, but had never been activist organizers. And, the anti-war mobilizations came out of a coalition of established organizations. The women's marches, by contrast, emerged as this kind of organic viral groundswell on the internet. And it was out of those that people formed what turned into thousands and thousands of local grassroots resistance groups, most of which are not women's march groups, most of which are affiliated with Indivisible or some other network, but which emerged out of that political space that was opened up by those marches.
You talked about the morale issue, which is quite critical. I'm thinking of some of the more recent examples where people mobilized around a concrete thing and failed, and that was the seating of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. I know you were also involved in some of those protests, very, very serious and strong protests, and that had to be quickly mobilized against the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh and around the testimony of Christine Blasey Ford. Did that loss demoralize people? I mean, the fact that it happened right before the midterm elections caused a lot of fear in many progressives.
I mean, that was a devastating loss. And it was, I think it was wrenching for people all around the country. Those of us who were there in D.C. as it was unfolding in that last stage, it was an especially just harrowing fight to be part of, because of course so many of the people who were on the front lines fighting were survivors of sexual assault who were having those memories brought up by the horror show unfolding in the Senate. I think it speaks to the real seriousness of purpose among the people who have mobilized against Trump, and by people I mean mostly women, because it has been mostly women. I think it speaks to the real seriousness of purpose that people were able to continue after that devastating defeat and still work as hard as they did around the midterms and sway things as substantially as they were able to, because that was a very hard loss. And one whose consequences will be living with for a long time. And it was, you know, particularly agonizing because in that very last stage, there was a feeling of just exhaustion. And we never had that sense of a surge like happened around the Muslim ban protests when people rushed to airports all around the country. We never had that moment where everybody just rushed to DC to shut down Kavanaugh in huge numbers. We had like 1,000 or 2,000 people. We never had our 10,000, 20,000, 50,000 person protest, you know, surrounding the Senate office building. Which, you know, might have turned the tide. I think, like many people, I was concerned that was a prelude to a set of devastating losses in the midterms, and it was not.
Ellie, what impact do you think the goal of a protest has on the sustenance of protest? Because when you're trying to say stop a war, it's a huge thing. And when you fail, it's dispiriting. But when you have a broader desire to curtail US foreign policy and to hold accountable those people who send Americans off to fight in wars that kill other people, then the loss of a protest can be seen as, you know, the loss of a battle in a larger war, to use fighting metaphors. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering how important it is for the sustainability of a protest to set one's sight on the broader battle.
I mean, I think, as you alluded to before, foreign policy affecting the conduct of U.S. empire has proved enormously difficult. So there's a way in which it is its own challenge that is so great that one has to consider it just, you know, a bigger lift for any movement, however well organized a campaign of action is, however well organized a given protest is. That said, I think, you know, I think it's interesting to think about, you know, one of the critiques that people often made about Occupy was that it didn't have demands. Yes, of Occupy Wall Street and all the Occupy encampments, that they didn't have demands. And neither did the first set of women's marches. They didn't have demands. There are moments when you want to have a protest that's, you know, very specifically like, I'm just thinking of a recent one here in New York City, you know, let's get this tear gas manufacturer whose company, you know, manufactured the tear gas that was just used against babies at the border. Let's get him off the board of the Whitney Museum. That's a very, you know, achievable goal. And you can have a series of protests that are pushing for that. What's powerful about these protests that step back from that is the way in which they can, whether it's Occupy Wall Street or the women's marches, these kind of broader containers can open up space for things to happen that you would never even predict, that they create a sense of empowerment, which is sort of deeper and more fundamental than any given action or campaign. So when I talk about looking at the long-term effects of a protest, sometimes they're that, you know, with Occupy, I think you can go back and trace a whole set of projects that emerged out of that gathering of energy that weren't, you know, wasn't Occupy Wall Street itself, but, you know, the way in which that energy and that framework moved into the Black Lives Matter movement, into the pipeline protests, into a whole series of other actions that have had lasting effects.
So in your many years of organizing and studying organizing and protests, at this particular moment, are you heartened by what you've seen transpiring? Because our newest challenge is, of course, the Trump presidency, but also everything that the Trump presidency represents. We mentioned the midterm election results as being a really good result in that direction, particularly the election of some very progressive first-time people to Congress and the Democratic Party and even other positions in local elections who are already showing, even before they've been formally seated, and presumably after are you know, making waves. So there's definitely some cause for optimism. But in the longer term, how do you assess where we are right now in the goal of ending Trumpism?
Right. It's something I think on often, that we're in a moment where, as we said at the opening of this conversation, there's been more protest and more people mobilized than at any previous point in U.S. history, which is very encouraging and very heartening. And also the ways in which it seems like that mobilization, people have been acting in ways that seem very smart and savvy and focused, is all very encouraging. It's not clear yet whether our power, our collective power, is adequate to dislodge Trump definitively. There are certainly promising signs that, you know, that for instance, by flipping the House, you know, there suddenly is leverage to investigate Trump in all kinds of ways that weren't possible. There's all, you know, the having Democrats hold the gavel in those committees in the House means that there's all kinds of investigations that can be pursued, and of course impeachment can be pursued. We don't have the votes to convict Trump in the Senate, but if we're thinking of impeachment as a pressure tactic, not necessarily as like a legalistic procedure, there's grounds for optimism there to, you know, up the pressure on Trump and isolate him politically. You know, having been politically active my whole life, and through some times that felt very dire and very bleak. I think about the period after 9/11 and some of the really grim periods in the Bush years when the protest was really criminalized in America and it was felt like the space for dissent was evaporating. You know, the threat now, the threats, plural, from everything from, you know, climate crisis to mass deportations to rising white supremacy feel so much larger and more menacing than what we've experienced in recent decades. I keep going by looking at, you know, the incredible heart and skill and energy that people, mostly women at the grassroots, have brought to fighting back. And I hold on to the victories that we've won close to my heart, because I think that is what sustains us to keep fighting in what are you know, going to still be at least two more very rough years for the United States.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck with the book.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you. My guest has been L.A. Kaufman. She has spent more than 35 years immersed in grassroots movements as a journalist, historian, organizer, and strategist. She's written about organizing and social movement history in publications like The Guardian, The Nation, The Progressive, and more. Her earlier book was called Direct Action, Protest and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. We've been discussing her newest book, How to Read a Protest, The Art of Organizing and Resistance. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram at RU with Sonali.